Welcome to the Money Maze podcast. I'm Simon Brewer, and Will Campion and I have created this show to explore and unravel some of the mysteries surrounding the investment business. We hope through direct and insightful interviews with masters of the real-life money maze, we're going to learn about different approaches to allocating capital, making investment and business decisions, and navigating the pitfalls that line the paths to prosperity. Whether you're a current or aspiring investor, entrepreneur, professional, or a student exploring career options, we hope you gain some helpful insights and enjoy the shows. You can keep up to date by visiting moneymazepodcast.com and please sign up to our newsletter to ensure you won't miss a release. If you enjoy the show, please subscribe and we'd love you to tell a friend or colleague about it. Thank you for listening.
I'm Will Campion and co-founder of the Money Maze podcast. And we're delighted to have Schroders as a sponsor and corporate partner. Schroders is a global investment and wealth manager with a purpose to provide excellent performance to clients through active investment management. By serving institutions and individuals worldwide, Schroders serves wider society. Channeling capital into sustainable and durable businesses accelerates positive change in the world. Funding the future is also a privilege. Schroders use it wisely and responsibly. As we know, capital is at risk with investing. Bremont is also a sponsor of the Money Maze podcast. Bremont is an award-winning British company that produces beautifully engineered chronometers designed to appeal to those who share the passion and appreciation of the innovation and mastery behind a beautiful mechanical wristwatch. Brought to you by the luxury British watchmaker Bremont.
Some of the most successful companies financed via venture capital and our household names, Facebook, Uber, Twitter, Airbnb and PayPal. And whilst financing businesses has been with us for centuries, the Dutch East India Company of the 16th century is often viewed as one of the world's first venture corporations. But venture capital specifically took on more of its current shape in the mid-20th century in the United States, and over the last two decades has moved from niche to mainstream for the larger institutional investors. And in the second quarter of 2021 alone, VC investment hit a new record high, reaching $157 billion just for the quarter. So today we're going to talk VC, and my guest is in Maryland, USA, and I'm delighted to welcome Hunter Somerville, VC heavyweight, formerly the general partner at Greenspring and now post-merger partner at StepStone. So Hunter, welcome to the Money Maze podcast.
Simon, thanks for having me. Long-term listener and a pleasure to be more actively involved today.
Well, before I even ask you about your early years, Hunter Somerville, that is a great name. It could have been taken from a Jane Austen novel or a sequel of Gone with the Wind. Where do the Somervilles come from?
I'm a bit of an amalgamation of all different parts of the United Kingdom. The Hunter part was actually the last name of my great-grandfather, who was a coal miner in Scotland. And then the Somerville part came from my grandfather on my dad's side. So we sort of put a little bit of Ireland and Scotland together.
Well, tell me a little bit about what sticks with you most about growing up and parental lessons along the way.
Yeah, so I'm actually from Baltimore, Maryland originally, and now I get to live here. In about 2 weeks, I'll be turning 40. So pretty much my entire 40 years have been in this general area in the mid-Atlantic, about 45 minutes outside of Washington, D.C. It was a great place to grow up and live. And the only time I've actually left to live somewhere else is when I went to University of Pennsylvania in Philadelphia, which was still, you know, an hour and a half Amtrak train ride away. So this has been a good spot for me. I get to live 15 minutes from my parents now. And you would never consider this to be a hotbed for venture capital activity in the mid-Atlantic in Baltimore, Maryland. But it's worked well, and actually there are a lot of ties to early roots of venture capital. New Enterprise Associates was started here. T. Rowe Price is based here, which has become very active in crossover investing on the venture side. And more than anything, it's just a nice place to live. And my network's here, and being able to do it and stay here has been wonderful. In terms of my background, I had two great parents who set an example for me on what marriage should look like and how to respect and love each other. And basically set a very high bar for me when I would eventually find and marry my wife, who came from Western Pennsylvania, a really humble, great woman that I'm lucky to still call my wife and who I justify being a good husband to every day as I balance it with work. And they just set great life lessons for me around grit and perseverance and making sure that you're bringing a high standard to everything you do on a day-to-day basis. And those lessons have stuck with me. Never try to be complacent. Approach every day with a rigor around getting stuff done and setting goals and completing them, and appreciate that those kind of bars were set for me from the very beginning, and try to do the same now that I'm a father of two young kids.
Great. Well, thank you for that. So you go to the University of Pennsylvania, and you also have added to that an MBA from the University of Maryland. Tell me a little bit about what you thought in choosing first degree and then the MBA.
Yeah, so I went to University of Pennsylvania. I actually applied early. That's where I wanted to go. I actually visited probably 50 colleges, which for people who know me wouldn't surprise you. Pretty thorough. Look at all of the different options out there. But loved University of Pennsylvania. I ended up majoring in international relations, which was sort of a combination of economics, political science, and history. Selfishly, I love history. If I could have majored in history and felt like it would be a good conduit to getting into business, I probably would have done so. But I got a third of that through the international relations major and then mixed in the other two categories, which were also great. I actually went into college thinking I would go into law or do something on the legal side and ended up preparing that way. Took a bunch of legal studies classes at Wharton to complement the international relations piece, and came out of college thinking that that would be the direction I would go in. Took the LSAT, actually didn't do very well on the LSAT. The logic piece, I think, tripped me up. And I decided to work as a paralegal just to see what that kind of career would be like coming out of school rather than investing in spending the money to go to law school and fully committing myself. And didn't like it at all and decided to veer and go in a different direction. And because I had done a lot in history and other more mainstream liberal arts areas, I had not taken a lot in finance or accounting or other areas that are obviously important to go into something more in traditional business. And so got my MBA at University of Maryland because it was a good school and because I could drive from Baltimore. And to my earlier introduction, staying here and being a part of this community was important to me. And I commuted every day to College Park, driving like an hour and a half to do that on a full-time basis and get it done. And rounded out my background, taking a lot in finance, accounting and strategy, areas I just had not done anything in at the University of Pennsylvania.
So you and me both are lovers of history. We were lucky enough to have Professor Neil Ferguson on last November. And next month, we have Peter Frankopan, who's head of global history at Oxford, coming as well, wrote the Silk Road. So I'm looking forward to that. So let's jump into VC, because it's VC and growth equity funds that are your expertise. You're a general partner at Greenspring Associates for 10 years, and I know the ink is barely dry on the merger with StepStone. But let's just start with maybe a high-level question, which is that going back to the 1980s and 90s, I think it'd be fair to say venture capital was viewed as too exotic to be anything other than occasional for most institutional investors. And it has moved, as I said earlier on, much more mainstream. What happened?
That's a fair characterization. And obviously, over the past few years, it's gone up in popularity even more than it has going back 5 to 10 years. Venture capital at the very beginning, it's always been about fueling innovation and backing founders that dare to dream and do something inspiring and need capital on that journey to build something scaled and significant. Going back to the formation of venture really with outside capital, which is really credited to George Doriot back in the day. Before that, it was angel investors backing companies or high net worth family offices backing companies until folks started raising from outside institutions. As you mentioned, in the 80s and 90s, you had some institutions investing very small percentages of their total AUM into the category. No one thought of it as a particularly impactful category within their overall allocation, and that has very much changed. And I think it's because the innovation trends, the tech trends that we're seeing, basically the viability of the categories that venture is active in, have become much more significant, require more capital to get to scale and significance. And people are really excited about trying to get exposure to those trends earlier on than they have done historically. The other thing that you saw going back was that most of the appreciation in these assets actually happened on the public side. So you would have businesses that got financed on the private side, would quickly go public at much less revenue scale. And then you would see massive appreciation that would occur once these businesses were public. And that allowed public investors, particularly microcap public investors, to do very well on these companies. You know, even looking back at like Apple and Google, when they went out and went public. What has changed now is that all of that appreciation is generally happening more significantly on the private side. So for folks that want to get that exposure, they need to think about doing it earlier, dipping down to the private side rather than waiting. And that's also why you've seen so much crossover activity, so much involvement from hedge funds that are now starting their own venture funds or their own private vehicles. Folks realize that they can't wait too long to really take advantage of that multiple appreciation, and that will continue to happen on the private side for the time being.
I think we've seen recently some very impressive numbers posted by the VC space. And I was wondering if you could comment on how widespread you think those returns are, or if they've in fact been quite concentrated in some of the Ivy League funds that have had access to the best managers for longer.
Yeah, I mean, I think endowments have embraced venture for the longest period of time, and obviously a lot of good news coming out around their performance, which is publicly disclosed. I think you just really have to look at the data, and obviously Cambridge is a good authority for that. If you look at Horizon pooled returns over a long period of time, it's pretty interesting. The 25-year Horizon pooled return is at about 32%, the 10-year at about 18%, and the 5-year at 23%. If you look at the 1-year, it's above 80%. So clearly a very good return over the past year, but not indicative of anything over the longer term, but still instructive. And that compares well even against buyout, where the 25, when I last saw, was around 13%. And the 5-year was at about 18%. So venture, while still much smaller as part of the allocation pie, has certainly done well now over a longer period of time, if you believe the benchmark data and what's been provided there. And even if you just look at distributions versus contributions, distributions have generally exceeded contributions over the past few years on the venture side too. So we generally think it's pretty healthy. And the performance at a benchmark level tells a good story.
And when you get a number like that 80%, which is outside of the normal distributions, how do you reflect on that in terms of what's happened? And is there anything you can take from it, good or bad?
No, I really take nothing from it. It's a 1-year look at an asset class where the story is generally told over 12 to 15 years. So I think what it tells you is, growth funds have had nice markups in the past year, and that companies are raising capital quickly round after round. But I would view nothing around it over a longer term basis.
Knowing this space as well as you do and interacting with institutional allocators, what's your feel for what the weights are and the likely trajectory over the over the next 5 to 10 years?
Yeah, I mean, I'd go once back to the data again rather than just speaking from my own perspective. If you look at ENF generally, the data I've seen is it's gone from about 2 to 6% as a mean allocation over the past 10 years from 2009 to 2019. For top decile performers that have shown the best performance, it's gone from like 6% to 15% as an allocation venture. The top performers have obviously overweighted it in a more significant way.
Do you think that there's a sense in the VC community that they need to stay with these investments longer than they used to and used to think about?
I don't think they really have a choice. They are staying with these companies longer because the companies themselves are staying private longer. It's not a question of whether they want to get out or can get out. You can always sell into a growth round if there's no signaling risk, and many high net worths, friends and family, seed investors, angels can do that. Generally, that's not seen as a good approach or an acceptable approach for people that have come in between Series A, B, C. Generally, you're committing to a company and a founder to stay with it through an IPO or an M&A, and getting out quickly would not be something that would be viewed favorably or would create goodwill in the future around founder referrals, et cetera. So as a result of that, you are waiting till the exit actually happens, and companies are in no hurry to pursue that too aggressively because there's ready amounts of capital available in the later stages on the private side, and no real reason to rush to do anything until you feel like you've got complete visibility and forecasting, you're a good public story, or you want to consider a financial transaction or an M&A transaction for whatever reason.
So as I understand it, you, your own specialty is sourcing venture funds of all stages, early and growth stage companies investing alongside the managers that you use, and secondary opportunities. Maybe you could just dive into those three components.
Sure. And just to give a little bit more background on how I started in this industry, coming out of that MBA program we talked about, I got an internship at a firm called Camden Partners in Baltimore. And what they did was invest both directly into growth businesses, as well as to invest in top tier funds, not venture specific. It actually did buyout, private equity, growth equity, royalty, mezzanine, and venture. So it was a great way for me to start looking at alternative asset investing, because I got exposure to all of these different categories you could choose from across the alternative spectrum. Venture to me appealed more than others because I liked being involved with disruptive technology trends at the very beginning with businesses that had very small amounts of revenue. And so rather than continue to do all of those areas, which plenty of people could do working at an endowment or a foundation as a head of private equity or a head of alternatives, I decided to focus my career on venture. And at that point, I moved over from Camden to Greenspring as an associate. So I joined in the same capacity, the same level on the junior side, working through and evaluating all of these opportunities, and was just thrilled to be able to do it exclusively in venture. That was not a trivial choice because, as we've talked about, venture back then was not a huge part of the allocation pie for alternative assets. And most people would have considered that to be a pretty niche career choice, going into something this narrow and specializing that significantly. Unlike many of your prior guests, I can't wax prophetically on all different asset classes. Venture capital is what I know. It's all that I focus on. And I can go very deep on it, thankfully. And part of the reason that I can is because we do fund investing, we do direct company investing, and we do secondary investing. So we are actually involved in all different structural categories of investing in venture, which is a pretty unique purview and perspective to have. Ultimately, it all goes back to the fund investing first and foremost. So what we do is we identify and access who we think are the best early stage venture investors out there, folks that are coming in and supporting a founder at the seed and Series A stage. That's when businesses have zero to maybe a few customers in revenue. So literally you're investing behind a team and a plan and nothing else. There's no traction you can sink your teeth into. There's no DCF analysis that you can run. You are literally backing people with transformative ideas that have yet to be proven. So what we look for is those folks that have the best access to that founder community and who would be viewed as the best partners to those founders as they continue their journey. And we invest behind those funds and support those funds so they in turn can support the best founders. When we do direct and secondary investing, all of that originates from those original funds that we've backed. So we create effectively a flywheel in our own ecosystem where we can then partner with the early stage funds to become an expansion stage lead on a financing afterwards. So we will not come in typically at a seed or Series A phase. We allow that to be done by the benchmarks, the Excels, the founders funds of the world, Sequoia, et cetera, that are very well known in investing in very early stage businesses. And then where we invest directly at a company is generally once they get to 10 million to 30 million in revenue, are scaling rapidly, and where we can come in and provide additional fuel to continue to help them scale and get bigger and more significant in size. And on a secondary basis, what we do there is provide liquidity to employees as these companies stay private longer and as folks would like to get partial liquidity to live their lives, to buy a house, to buy a car, whatever else they need to do, or provide liquidity to other LPs that want to use that capital from an opportunity cost standpoint to invest somewhere else. So we basically participate either through fund direct or secondary in every part of the venture life cycle from the very beginning to when a company eventually goes public, is bought by private equity, is bought by a strategic, or goes public through a SPAC. And that's where we're actively involved.
So I would be the first to confess that venture capital is unfamiliar territory for me. And as I was doing my research ahead of today, I read an interesting comment from Guy Kawasaki, the all-top co-founder and serial entrepreneur, who said, "Ideas are easy, implementation is hard." How do VC firms get good at this?
I think that's very true. Part of the reason why we don't do a lot of early stage direct investing ourselves, and why you need to build a diversified portfolio generally at an early stage of like 30 to 60 companies, because a lot of them are not going to work out. If you look at historic loss rates or write-off rates, you can generally expect that 30 to 40% of a portfolio will go completely to zero. So despite you having great teams and very high quality business plans, it doesn't mean that it's going to ultimately translate into success. You could run into competitors that are similar, that just execute better, and then you ultimately become obsolete. There is a very heavy amount of risk in getting going and starting a business and making it work. I think that's why it's so noble, the founder journey, becoming an entrepreneur, embracing that risk. It very much is part and parcel of the American dream and building something from nothing. And that's why it really resonates with me as someone who can provide capital to facilitate that. But you have to go in knowing that a lot of the time it won't work out. And so early stage venture investors build those diversified portfolios, and ultimately they look to back the best teams with the most relevant experience in the categories that they're looking to transform. So when you're identifying a team, you're looking for people that have done this, maybe not as a CEO or a founder, but in a relevant capacity at a prior business, and that are building a team around them to take on a very difficult problem and build something to solve that issue. And then you build a diversified portfolio of 30 to 50 of those. You try to be a value-added investor post-investment and helping them recruit, further build out the team, find beta customers, build something from the very beginning and help them scale. And then ultimately, you know, those teams that are effective will keep raising financing rounds after that to continue to prove it out further.
Yes. So you make a good point there. And you said 30 to 40% of those companies in a given portfolio will not make it. They'll go bust. And I had to compare that with, I think it was the Drew Houston, who is the founder of Dropbox, who said, "Don't worry about failure. You only have to be right once." Yeah, but that's fine if you're an entrepreneur, but it's not fine if you manage this pool of VC opportunities. And so let's just stay with that, differentiating the winners and the losers, because presumably your lessons from the losses have been pretty important for you in making better choices going forward.
Yeah. I mean, you have to embrace risk and loss in this asset class. If you go in thinking you're going to get it right 90% of the time, you're probably not going to pick the most exciting opportunities, because the big transformative meaty ones that take on the hardest problems are ultimately probably going to fail at a higher rate. You do have to embrace risk if you're going to invest in this category. That being said, if 30% of the portfolio goes to zero, typically the return profile you'll see is that at least one of the companies that remains returns at least the entire fund. And so you get those kind of outsized winners to compensate for the high loss rate of the businesses you invest in. And for people that are doing random angel investing and hoping that it works out by doing two or three companies as a seed investor, it's not really a great strategy, I think, for success within this category. And that's oftentimes why people will invest with a venture fund instead of doing stuff that they would source through their own seed network themselves as an angel investor. So those are the trade-offs that you need to consider. Ultimately, it's still hard to pick a winner going from zero in revenue to them having 100 million when they eventually go public, or more than that when they eventually go public. And so you really just have to back teams that you trust, that you think have the appropriate skill set to take on a difficult problem, and well situated in a category to disrupt it and do something that is transformative that typically doesn't even exist when they're getting it going. So it's not an easy identification technique, but the folks that do seed and Series A investing are very good at backing and picking people and then helping them try to take on those problems as a board member post-investment.
And can you maybe share with us one of those experiences and what you learned from an investment that really worked, but as valuably, one that didn't work and must have obviously hurt at the time?
When we invest directly in a company, it's at a different stage than what I'm just describing. So the early stage guys will back those companies from the very beginning with basically no revenue. Where we would get involved as an investor directly in a company is when they have around 10 million or more of forward revenue. So the de-risking that happens between 0 and 10 million is pretty significant. And generally for growth investors or expansion stage investors like us, those loss rates begin to look more like 10 to 20%. So you're not going to have as many things that go fully to zero, because hopefully when you've gotten to that stage, it's more of an execution bet that you're really taking on rather than a tech bet or a tech risk bet. It's a different kind of risk that you'd come into. That being said, the stage we invest, things do go wrong, and we've certainly had lessons learned. I think some things that we look back on, you can oftentimes feel comfortable that a business will work when they nail a market on a small scale in like one state or a few cities, and assume that just because it worked in those cities, it could scale and work nationally. And we've had businesses that have done that, and then the unit economics in other cities and states are not as favorable as that first initial market. And it requires a lot of cash burn to understand that and see that in effect. And so, you know, we've come in, we've provided capital to those companies, and then the unit economics, which we thought had been proven, ended up not being proven in those other geographies as they scale. And you need to be thoughtful and deliberate and balance growth with proving unit economics. And that's not an easy thing to do. That has certainly been one lesson that we've learned over time. Also, just building out a team is not easy. And just because you were a founder that was good at coming up with an idea, building a great product, does not mean that you're a founder that would be great leading a company once it gets to 30 to 50 million in revenue. And there are execution challenges that come in at those points of time. And sometimes you need to recognize that that's not where you're well suited and change your role, become head of strategy, become a board member, but not the actual operator anymore. And so it takes a level of humility as a founder to know where you're good, where you should stop, where you should bring in someone else. And that's hard. And not everyone gets that right. Sometimes folks stay on too long, and that can create challenges that businesses can't overcome, or it slows down growth and someone catches up to you or disrupts you or finds a better way to solve the problem you're tackling. And so you can't be complacent. You have to have humility, both as an investor and as a founder.
Yeah, we had Sir Ronald Cohen, the founder of Apex, on the show, and he talked about how hard it was in those early days of putting this together. But just a follow-on question. Have you developed what one might term red lines when you're looking at some of these venture firms you might work with in terms of things that will put you off that make doing business with a group just a no-go?
Yeah, when we look at venture funds, we really want to see groups that we think have differentiation in sourcing, post-investment value add, and in building an enduring and long-term organization. So team chemistry and health is really important. Firms have been destroyed countless times by poor generational transitions, folks staying on too long, not nurturing or building their younger group. And that can really destroy venture firms where there's a lot of nuance into doing that correctly. We are also big believers in diversity within venture organizations, and that being thoughtfully done from the junior to the senior level. And so we like to see firms that embrace that, are thoughtful in implementing that in their recruitment and hiring practices, and that really care about building a best-in-breed organization with different perspectives in approaching problems and in sourcing great businesses. Obviously, venture is pretty narrow in what they will invest in. So it's technology or healthcare. You don't go into a lot of other areas that can become more problematic. But we also like to see a commitment to impact and investing behind businesses that are more significantly transformative. Me Too innovation is less exciting to us. We like folks that tackle big problems, that want to help the world, that want to deal with more complicated areas. You know, like climate change has become a lot more viable now within the venture ecosystem than it was in the first time that folks tried, where clean tech widely failed and where it was difficult and where a lot of venture investors lost their jobs because they couldn't do it well. Now climate change feels more of a viable category, and deep tech and areas around that, and tackling difficult issues. We like venture firms that aren't complacent and will go into those areas and try to really make a difference.
So when we think about those sectors, you talked about healthcare and tech, which obviously are getting a lot of attention right now. How do you go about building the skills that you want? And by that, I mean, you know, people come out with MBAs and they're great at financial modeling, but there's often a paucity of people who have maybe been in the biotech industry or have worked in technology. How do you put that skill set together to make a rounded team?
That's what we really look for in our early stage investors. If they're going to be investing in healthcare, we would like to see that they have a background in healthcare, either as a former operator, having worked an associate and risen within a firm, investing in that category, building a network in that category, developing pattern recognition in that category. Even within our team, Adair Newhall, who works on healthcare more significantly than some of us, worked for multiple healthcare startups, worked for a healthcare venture firm. So we don't think it's something that's easy to do coming in from purely a banking standpoint and being able to have that network and that identification ability. Within tech, when we invest behind folks on the seed or early stage side, we want to see that they have come from that world, like I said, either as an operator or having come up within an organization on the venture side and learned from folks that have invested there and built a network organically among the founder community. And so it's not something you can rush into doing or being good at overnight. And having those relevant networks from a sourcing and identification standpoint are really important.
I know you sit in the US, and I imagine that you can find more than enough opportunities in the US. Do you cast your net wider? We've got a lot of VC going on in Israel, in the UK, and lots of other parts where there's innovation and entrepreneurialism. How do you think about the lens through which you look?
Yeah, we've actually been global investors for a long time. So we've been investing in Asia since 2005, the UK and Europe more broadly, even before that. Israel, I think our first commitment was in 2008. We've now become more active over recent years in Southeast Asia, in Latin America. We've been invested in India for about 12 years. So we've touched the relevant international geographies, and we're frankly excited about doing a lot more. When I started in the business, the belief was you should only invest in companies that are within walking distance or biking distance of your office. And I think that very much has changed. Innovation is everywhere. You need to pick the best companies that can take on a category wherever they're located. And companies increasingly compete against each other, even if they're located in different countries. And so having that perspective, broad point of view is really critically important. And frankly, that is part of the attraction of joining up with StepStone that has 19 global offices, that has folks on the ground in all of these places. We had begun to build that as part of Greenspring, and this supercharges our efforts to be an even broader, bigger global organization. But we've got good pattern recognition, having invested in Asia for 15 years, which is longer than most folks. And a lot of these businesses have become very significant in their own right. You have early stage funds in all of these different areas that are backing these businesses. But once they get to a growth stage or considering going public, you will see folks anywhere invest in best in breed companies wherever they're located. Where you still see some adherence to that proximity argument is in that seed Series A phase, where being actively involved, interacting with them on, you know, a weekly basis is important, and proximity helps there.
And when you look at Asia, has that same pattern you mentioned earlier of firms staying private for longer before they list played out as well? And I say that because there is something in some parts of that Asian culture which is about being more transaction orientated.
Yeah, I think hold periods are getting longer everywhere. Companies have no rush to go out and go public until they feel like they're completely ready to do so, and they're happy to remain private. And there's plentiful amounts of capital to invest in private tech businesses and healthcare businesses. As we talked about a little bit up front, venture has changed significantly from what it was, and now it's gone up significantly in terms of allocation percentage for most investors. Folks are deploying more to the category. And where you're seeing the most activity of size and significance is in those growth rounds, where folks are dipping down and doing pseudo-like IPOs of hundreds of millions in size, the size of what IPOs would have been 10 years ago. So whether it's Asia, whether it's the US, whether it's Israel, companies will choose to raise that capital until they feel like they really want to be and see benefits from being a public business. For investors in venture, they need to be more comfortable and patient with those dynamics because they're going to be holding these assets longer. They're not going to get capital back as quickly, but arguably because they'll stay private longer, you should get end of day higher multiple upside as a result of that patience. So that's the balance that any investor needs to consider from a cash flow standpoint and when they're considering investing in this category.
Now, all of that is well and good, but courtesy of the central banks, money has been made unbelievably cheap for a very long time. And as a result of that, there's a lot of capital sloshing around chasing deals. I think it might have been your own on your own website. There's this statement, innovation is pervasive, but capital is a commodity. And I think I've seen that late stage valuations have doubled recently. I read that year to date, median valuation for late stage deals is now over $1 billion. Aren't you worried by this enormous tidal wave of capital?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's very true around the pervasiveness of capital. Folks want exposure to alternative assets. They want to invest more on the private side. We've discussed the difficulties of public market investing, particularly in tech and healthcare. And when a lot of the arbitrage is still happening on the private side, that is why you're seeing so many public investors, hedge funds, et cetera, dip down and try to get exposure, even at the tail end of the private continuum, where they're only coming in 2 years before an IPO. I think that still speaks to their point of view that waiting until the businesses go public is probably a worse option than not getting any exposure on the private side. And increasingly, new pools of capital are coming on board. High net worth investors are looking for more exposure in private assets. So I honestly don't see a lot that's going to change that desire. And it's not just in venture, it's in buyout, it's in all parts of private equity. People want more in private asset exposure. Valuations have gone up. They've gone up the most significantly in those later stage rounds because that's where you have the most pools of capital. That's where they're more comfortable with the risk return profile and not having those full write-offs like we discussed with the early stage or the expansion stage folks. So I think where you will continue to see the highest pricing is in that very late stage private investing. What always happens though is the public market changes. And as you mentioned, when that liquidity stops, public pricing in tech assets will inevitably go down. And those folks that are straddling the line between private and public will adjust because the multiples that the public market investors are paying will come down, and therefore folks on the private side will stop paying multiples they think are the same or that offer an arbitrage. But I don't think interest level in private investing will change. I think there's still a lot of folks that need to increase overall allocations to venture and to other categories in privates. And so there will certainly be cyclicality. Pricing will remain high, but businesses will build more significant scale on the private side and will to some degree justify higher pricing than we've seen historically. But I wouldn't sit here and say I think it's an overly inexpensive time to be getting late stage private tech exposure. I just don't think that that would be authentic. And I could say the same about the public side right now in the same categories.
Which I suppose makes me wonder who is not right for this asset class as a buyer. Who, in your opinion, is entering into the fray here, who you would advise if you were sitting there just as a broader asset allocator to be very cautious?
I honestly don't think there's anyone that shouldn't be able to get private market exposure and in turn venture. I just think there's different ways to do it. And it's a question of how much diversification you need to add to make sure you're not taking on too much risk. But as a firm and organization, we've always been believers in democratizing access to venture capital and to alternative assets more broadly. And so I wouldn't sit here and say, I don't think it should be part of a high net worth portfolio. It just should be done thoughtfully. So instead of doing two or three seed investments and calling that your venture allocation, consider investing through a fund-to-fund structure or a very diversified fund that offers you good risk mitigation. There's different ways to play venture. It's not a one-size-fits-all. But I think getting private tech and healthcare exposure is something that everyone should consider thoughtfully for their own respective portfolios. It just needs to be done differently.
So you mentioned SPACs earlier on. We actually haven't talked about SPACs on any of our podcasts. Special purpose acquisition companies. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Correct. Yeah. Yep.
Now, it's easy to say it's symptomatic of late cycle, cheap money, et cetera, but I'm not sure that's right. And I was looking at a potential investment a few weeks ago where this SPAC had more cash than the market cap and seemed to be having quite a prodigious sort of revenue stream. Just tell me, what are you seeing and what are you thinking about the SPAC space?
Yeah, I think it's very different than a year ago. It's already become a lot harder to pull off SPACs than it was literally just 12 to 18 months ago. You saw a fever pitch of SPACs that were raised and pipe financings that were getting completed. And now it's become a much higher bar to pull anything off. And I think that's because raising a pipe is not easy. You need to bring in very high quality crossover investors or folks that believe in that company or have some tie to that company. And without the pipe, just much harder to pull off. We saw that as a very viable exit avenue, and it began competing against private equity as an acquirer and IPO as an option, but they have slowed down in terms of being able to be completed. It's not as fast of an exit avenue as it once was, and completing the pipe is much more difficult. And so I don't think it's going to go away. I think it will remain a fourth leg of the stool alongside of IPO, strategic M&A, and financial buyer, but the bar will be high. And I think it should be, because the rigors and requirements of being a public company are not trivial. And what we were seeing a lot of the SPACs take out in terms of acquisition targets were businesses that were much earlier in their trajectory. Very disruptive companies, very bold visions, but oftentimes earlier in revenue or even pre-revenue in certain circumstances. And companies that hadn't gotten comfortable with financial forecasting, having predictability around their revenue streams or their forecasts. And that can create a lot of difficulty and variability once those businesses eventually go public. And so I think that the bar needs to be high. The sponsor quality on the SPAC side needs to be very high. And there were too many people with no experience doing this that saw it as an interesting category at that moment and became involved. So I welcome it, the winnowing of the herd, but I also don't think it disappears as a category. And the best groups that have picked the best companies that have long-term viability and have done it the right way will survive. And there will obviously be a lot more regulation around this category too, which is probably appropriate.
I want to come back to that discussion on geographic investing. Particularly, we had Arjun Raghavan, who's the new CEO at Partners Capital, on the podcast a couple of weeks ago, and he was talking about the absolute immutable secular trend of capital moving towards Asia. And I wondered, given both the opportunity, but you know, the challenges operating in another theater like that, when you're doing your scrutiny about manager selection, particularly maybe when it comes to China, where there's a history of challenges investing in this space, what extra, if not safeguards, but what have you changed in your process as you go about thinking of investing there?
Yeah, so most of the groups that we've backed in China are folks that we've known for a long period of time. Many of the groups that have emerged as the best Series A investors started as part of global brands. So they worked at groups that did US investing, European investing, investing in Israel, and then built a team in China as part of those organizations. And so when they decided to spin out and start their own firm or to start their own fund as part of a broader platform and organization, these were folks we had already worked with for 5 to 10 years before they decided to do that. And it just creates a de-risking mechanism where we know the people, we know that they've been grown under folks that we trust with great organizational practices of institutional quality. And so that is really the profile of most of the groups that we've backed in China specifically. And you know, also in other areas like India. These are not relationships to be rushed into. There are all kinds of firms that come out of nowhere with interesting operators or associates or VPs that decide to start their own firm, but we would prefer to just not take on that additional risk, and we would rather organically develop those relationships over a longer period of time, see them in action, see how they build the firm, see how they add a COO, see what kind of third-party providers they use, get comfortable with all of their organizational practices and them as partners. So I would say we're more deliberate than other allocators, not just in China, in all different international geographies.
So it's interesting. I want to turn the lens because there are you having been a partner at Greenspring for a long time, and then you've just gone through this merger with StepStone. I'm sure there were other partners who might have courted you and looked at you. As you did that due diligence on the partner, what was really important for you and your colleagues as you went through that appraisal?
We have always been venture specialists, and that's all that we've done. Now, we've done that through investing in funds, investing in companies, investing in secondaries. But where we think the world is going is more around consolidated providers across all different alternative asset categories. And we don't have the expertise to build a buyout practice or to build a hedge fund practice or an alternative lending practice. We are venture specialists. It's what we've done. It's what we've loved. It's what we're passionate about. It's what we honestly want to continue doing. But we do think there are advantages in being part of a firm that does all of the other categories as well, with best in breed teams globally located, practicing their craft. And what StepStone has built is effectively a team of teams and high quality teams wherever they're located. And in venture growth, we think we can bring a lot to their broader organization as an active participant in that category. Really continuing to do what we're doing under a broader, bigger, institutionalized public company, which we think offers best in breed shared services in terms of investor relations, in terms of data tracking, in terms of global presence. The global presence piece, I think, is increasingly important. It's something we would have wanted to build out ourselves anyway, but putting together 19 offices takes time, and building trust with people in all different locations takes time. And we had started down that avenue, but this obviously supercharges it in a much more de-risked format. And also just in terms of data tracking, data collection, pulling insights and analytics out of it, I think StepStone is really best in breed in that capacity too. And these are folks and people that we've known for a long period of time that we like, that we have cultural and value alignment with, and that we're excited about building something scaled and significant over time while still maximizing that value for our investors and underlying LPs.
And if you were to summarize ultimately what it is that in your space gives you that competitive advantage, what would be those two or three things?
Relationships. Venture is always about relationships and depth of relationship. And we don't take any of that for granted. All of those early stage firms that we've been able to partner with for 10 to 20 years, we have a lot of humility around that. We have deep appreciation for their craft, their ability to be great partners to founders. And similarly, with all the companies that we invest in at expansion stage, those relationships with the founder community and hopefully our ability to prove value through corporate connections, customer introductions, recruitment assistance. We don't want to be a passive capital provider. We want to be an active participant either to the fund managers that we back or to the founder community that we back. And if our reputation isn't known for that, when references occur and founders have the ability to work with anyone or funds have the ability to work with any type of institution, they wouldn't pick us. Relationships matter a lot more here than they do in other areas.
Hunter, before I ask you some general concluding questions, if you were approached by an MBA from your alma mater saying, where should I start my career? Would you be encouraging them to start their career in finance in your space?
I wouldn't encourage them to start it immediately in our space, but I would say over the long term, it's a great place to be involved. Where you should start is as an operator or in some capacity in a company. I think that's the best experience. Frankly, I wish I had done that in my career, but I had an unexpected path into what I ultimately ended up doing. But work for a startup, see the bones of it, see how difficult it is, the challenges, the joy, the pain that goes into it. Add value in a small business. You're obviously going to take on a lot more roles and responsibilities than you would in a much larger organization. Get your hands dirty, learn from that, and then you'll be more effective at advising startups on what to do if you've actually lived a day of their journey. I would start there, and startups are always looking for help from junior level people doing all different kinds of things, either on the product side or the business development side, and do that first. People are always in such a hurry to go directly to where they want to be instead of building the building blocks that would create more endurance and you being great in that category. And so don't rush into being a venture capitalist. Do things to make yourself a better long-term venture capitalist.
Ah, that's good advice. Now, you've met lots of investors. Who in the world of investing, no boundaries, would you most like to have dinner with, and where would you have that dinner?
I think George Doria, who I mentioned up front, just as like the father of venture capital, would be someone that I would prioritize. I'm also lucky in that the founder of our firm, Ashton Newhall's father, started NEA, which is now one of, if not the largest venture capital firms in existence. And so I actually get to have lunch with him and dinner from time to time and learn from Chuck Newhall and what it took to become one of the three founders of NEA, which has been just a real blessing for me being in Baltimore, Baltimore kid, and having someone like that three offices down from me from time to time. But George Doria would be great to understand venture at its roots. And Chuck Newhall is just a blessing that I get to interact with anyway.
The second part of that is you're going to have that dinner. You travel across the US and let's say I'm going to meet you for dinner in the US. Not that you want to have dinner with me, but let's just imagine you do. Where would you really like to eat?
Probably somewhere in California, just because despite everything we've talked about, the rise of innovation everywhere, there's still something special about being in the Valley and feeling it and seeing the billboards and the enthusiasm and excitement and unbridled optimism to some degree, which can also be a little bit dangerous from time to time. But there's something seductive about it. I very much believe great companies will be built everywhere, but there's still something special about the Valley.
And do you have a favorite book?
My favorite book is actually Great Expectations by Dickens. Ninth grade, I think I read it, and took a specific class on Dickens, which was great. Read David Copperfield. And I just love Great Expectations. I think what I try to keep in mind as I get older and as I'm now a parent, and you have challenges that always come in on the personal side, is that as much as I love work and have had some level of success in work, which I don't take for granted and which I think could be completely fleeting, life is humbling and it can knock you down at any time. And what's great about Great Expectations is finding that balance, I think, in life. I always remember the quote from Joe the Blacksmith on life being so many partings welded together. Try to keep that in mind with everything I do.
Well, that's great, because in fact, we had one other guest, Charlotte Thorne from Capital Generation Partners, who also confess to being a great Dickens fan. So that's two in the space of 3 months. So that's great. And finally, Hunter, if you could tell us just one thing.
Yeah, well, I'll do another UK reference. I actually have a quote that's written on my whiteboard right in front of me in my office that I look at every day. And it just means a lot to me. It's from Winston Churchill. And it's, success is not final. Failure is not finite. It is the courage to continue that counts. One of the characteristics that we've always said defined our culture is grit and perseverance. We have everyone read Angela Duckworth's book, Grit, and we just very much believe in that as a core personality characteristic for success, is to push through walls, to get things done, to not accept failure as an ultimate leveler. And to our point around loss rate, if you got caught up in failure in venture, you wouldn't be very successful because you're going to experience a lot of it over time. And so I look at that every day.
Well, Hunter, that is candid and that is really helpful. I've enjoyed this conversation. I've learned a lot. I'm taking two pieces of advice again, because lots of young people who are at university listen to this show as well. And I like your idea. Get your hands dirty and join a startup, because there's a great preference to join the big brand names in all sorts of worlds that we know of, which might be a little bit more comfortable. And grit, not just the book, the action, the determination, the quality that is needed by all generations and is going to be needed a lot, I suspect, in the years ahead. So Hunter, fantastic. I'll stop talking. You have been great. It's been lovely having you here today. And I look forward to us. Well, we may not have dinner in California. Maybe it'll be in Maryland. But I look forward to meeting you face to face. So thank you so much.
Totally my pleasure. An honor to be asked to be involved, and hope this has been informative. And thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening to the Money Maze podcast. For more information or to subscribe, please visit themoneymazepodcast.com. Hope to see you next time. All content on the Money Maze podcast is for your general information and use only, and is not intended to address your particular requirements. In particular, the content does not constitute any form of advice, recommendation, representation, endorsement, or arrangement, and is not intended to be relied upon by users in making any specific investment or other decisions. guests, and presenters may have positions in any of the investments discussed.